moving or anything, and then you can close off the other. If you suspect that there's some sort of occlusion, you can do a feeding tube down to see if it will pass through, but that's only if you've identified for a fact that if there's an occlusion present or appears to be. Mouth, you want to insert usually your little finger into the mouth. You want to see if the baby will suck. And then you want to palpate the palate of the mouth to make sure that it is in fact intact. Also, feel, make sure there's no little teeth present. That can happen. It's not a normal thing, but they have been found. So, eyes, you know, you want to note, in fact, that there are eyes present. Sometimes the easiest way to get them to open their eyes is kind of darken the room and then kind of raise the baby up like to a sitting position, and usually they will open their eyes. The doctor will probably, when they do their physical exam, they'll also want to use the light, and they're looking for the red reflex, in that when they pass the light over the eye, they'll see the red dot like you do, you know. Well, y'all probably know because cameras have come a long way, but that used to always be a challenge sometimes in taking photographs, that you didn't get, you know, the red dot in the photograph. Then their ears. We talked about this when you were looking as far as assessing them for maturity. You want to note the location. You know, are they below the crease of the eye? Are they above? Do they have folds present? Do they readily recoil? Neck and chest, you want to just, you know, observe the neck. You can sit the baby up, kind of support the head, but then see, do they move any? Chest, again, you're looking for symmetry. Looking at movement, are there any retractions noted as the baby is breathing in and out? You're going to look, assess the nipples. Are they aligned? Where's their location? Moving down to the abdomen, you'll palpate to see if you feel anything abnormal. You're going to observe that the cord is clamped. If there's any cord past the clamp that you can see, you're going to look for the presence of three vessels. Ava, artery, vein, artery. There should be three vessels. If you cannot see looking at the cord, if there's three vessels, you'll want to check with the nurse that was in for delivery. Did she look at the placenta? Did she check the cord? You need to verify if there's three vessels present. If the baby doesn't have three vessels, oftentimes this can be indicative of a problem with the kidneys, and they're going to follow up with an ultrasound of the kidneys. So it is important to identify the presence of those three vessels. As we talked about, you're going to look at the genitalia. For the male baby, you're going to ascertain that the testicles have descended. You're going to look at the rugae on the scrotum for the presence of. The female, you will observe the minora, of the labia, the clitoris, that they're intact. Page 619, there's a picture, figure 18.6. Extremities and back, you're looking to see, is the baby moving all of his extremities? Are you observing maybe one of the arms is laying limp at the side? That could be indicative of maybe some sort of a brachial plexus. You will have already checked as you're coming down. I didn't mention on the chest, but you want to palpate the clavicles to make sure that they are intact. Your LGA babies are at risk for a fracture of the clavicle. If you're present at the delivery, you can usually hear when it pops as the baby's being delivered. As that anterior shoulder comes underneath the symphysis, if it's a difficult delivery, then you may hear, actually hear the clavicle pop. Treatment is just positioning of the baby. You're not gonna lay the baby on the side of the fractured clavicle. Sometimes you'll see them kind of put together using a couple diaper shirts where they have, you know, the first diaper shirt on the baby, they put the second one on and they bring the arm into that one just to kind of hold it up at its across its abdomen. But that's mainly positioning, not laying it on its side is the treatment for it. You're gonna check the back. You're gonna run your finger down the spine for intactness. You're gonna observe to see, does the baby have any kind of birthmarks? Does it have any Mongolian spots? Then the neurological status. We talked about this as far as observing for alertness, their posture. How are they laying? Are they moving all their extremities? And then table 18.4 and figures 18.17 and 18.18 talk about the alertness, the reflexes. One of the things I'm talking about, we didn't really go down here, kind of, well, under extremities, I guess. One of the things I need to remember and tell y'all about is when you are accessing the extremities on your baby, you want to observe, are the legs laying, are they equal in length? You want to assess for any kind of a hip dysplasia. And you'll do this by turning the baby over, laying the baby on its abdomen, and then taking the legs, extending them out straight, and you want to see that the little gluteal and the thigh creases match up, okay? That they are even, the little butt cheeks and the thigh, the creases there, do they match up? If you have one hip that is, say, dislocated, they're not going to, okay? So that would be indicative if they don't match up of a hip dysplasia. Babies that are breech birth are at a higher risk for this. I mean, you think about it, they've spent 9 months with their legs, say, up on their their feet on their shoulders or something, and they haven't moved those legs much, they're at a higher risk for it. So you'll want to be sure and check that. You'll want to remember that. Some of the common skin variations, we talked about the vernix, that's the cheesy-like substance. The older the baby, the less of that you're gonna see. It's primarily gonna be in the creases. You're not gonna try and rub it off, okay? Stork bites or salmon patches, those are the little red marks. They call stork bites because they're usually there on the back of the neck. Milia, looks like the little white pimples. This also may be known as, be described as a newborn rash, which is your erythema toxicum. It's a newborn rash. It is normal. You wanna star that, please. Mongolian spots are those dark spots that often are found on dark-skinned babies. It can be African-American, it can be of Mediterranean descent, Hispanic. Harlequin sign is the when you have the coloring of the baby on one side, maybe the baby gets redder on one side than the other. Pages 612 through 614 talk about some of these common skin variations. Nevus flammeus and nevus vasculosis. It's not unusual for babies to be born with some of these. Of course, the vasculosis are going to be the ones that are very vascular and therefore they may be harder to remove. Be familiar. Mongolian spots and erythema. More variations in the head size and shape of the newborn. You'll see on page 616, figure 18.4 covers the picture showing you of the molding. This usually resolves within a week. Your, I call it caput. Some people say put. Caput succedaneum. This is a poorly demarcated soft tissue swelling that crosses the suture lines. Remember, your caput crosses the suture lines. Pitting edema is observed. It usually will dissipate in about 3 days. Your cephalohematoma is a subperiosteal collection of blood of the skull confined to one cranial bone. It does not cross the suture lines. There's your difference. You need to remember that. You also want to note, because this is a collection of blood, you will be followed by typically bruising that will then be indicative of the baby is at a higher risk to develop bilirubin, hyperbilirubinemia, that occur with the breakdown of the RBCs within the hematoma. This hematoma usually appears on the second or third day, and it can take anywhere between weeks or months for it to dissipate. Abnormalities. Microcephalia. This is where the circumference of the baby's head is more than 2 standard deviations below average. This was identified, I don't know if you recall, a couple years ago when Zika?
Zika.
Yes. Was, you know, started appearing that these babies had microcephalia, had the small heads. Whereas macrocephalia, oftentimes, now this is going to be the large head. It is typically benign. More than 90% are related to hydrocephalus. The others may be familial. You know, you have a baby that seems to have a really big head. And, you know, mom or dad are saying, oh, my mama said I had a really big head when I was born. You know, it can be familial. Then you have large, small, or closed fontanelles. Large fontanelles are more than 6 centimeters in the anterior and more than 1 centimeter in the posterior. These are associated with malnutrition, hydrocephalus, hypothyroidism, or trisomies 13, 18, and 21. Small or closed fontanelles, sutures, are considered to be craniosynostasis and can result in abnormal brain development due to the premature fusion of the cranial suture lines. So you see why it's really important to be sure and assess those carefully. Okay, so again, here's that table. This is talking about the reflexes that I referred to earlier. So Babinski's, that's the, you know, where you run your finger up the sole of their foot and they flare their toes out. Morrow is also kind of a startle where you can kind of clap and the baby will startle. Ones to remember. So early newborn period, nursing interventions. As with just about everything you'll do in nursing, you begin your teaching from admission. So, you know, from birth, you'll start educating the parents on their newborn. Oftentimes a good time to do this is when you bathe the baby. You can do it there at the bedside, and you can go over the different things regarding the baby. So there's teaching guidelines on page 625. You'll want to be sure and review those. Nursing procedures also. on 626 that just cover, you know, obviously, you know, to prepare to bathe the baby, you're going to have gloves. You wear gloves around the newborn until they have been bathed, because you're not certain as to what they may have transmitted during the birthing process. So gloves on with newborns until they've been bathed. You're just going to use plain water on the face and the eyes, mild soap the rest of the baby. You're not going to immerse the baby in a tub, nor will they be immersed in a tub until the cord has fallen off, or if they've had a circumcision, until it is healed. And so you'll be instructing the parents that you do not immerse the baby in a tub until they're about 10 to 14 days. You'll give sponge baths until then. And it's important that the parents understand that. They can sponge the baby off till that occurs. I'll share with y'all, I have a great nephew. He married when he was, I think, 38. His wife was maybe 37. And a year later, they had their first baby. So they're very, you know, they're educated and they just want to do everything by the book. So they were told, do not put the baby in a tub until the cord drops off. Do not bathe the baby until the cord drops off. So they were very literal with that. They took that as that was the case, because they didn't follow up with sponge the baby off. So when my sister, the grandmother, went up to see the baby at about a week old, and she could see she had, you know, a little stuff kind of gear, and she said, you know, I'm going to take a washcloth and just wipe her off. And her daughter-in-law said, oh, no. They told us the hospital don't bathe her till the cord drops off. My sister is a nurse also, and she said, but you can sponge her off. So she gave the baby her first good sponge bath since she had been discharged from the hospital. So just keep in mind, what we say oftentimes to the parents is the gospel. So you want to be sure and clarify with them, yes, don't put the baby in a tub, but you can sponge the baby off. Just a mild soap and wipe it off, okay? Cord care is just keeping it, you know, clean and dry. They don't really do anything. Now, when I first started practicing, we put this purple dye on it. I forget what we called it. But, I mean, it was messy because it usually ended up all over the belly. And you, if you weren't careful. And they don't use that. Then we went to just using an alcohol just to wipe it off. And they really don't do that. But if it needs cleaning, I would say do that. Before the baby's discharged from the hospital, you'll want to make sure that the cord clamp has been removed. By this time, the cord should have dried up enough that it is safe to go ahead and remove the clamp. You'll want to instruct them when they're putting the diaper on the baby, as long as that cord is present, that they'll want to fold the diaper down below that cord. They don't want it rubbing on it. You want to instruct them to report to the healthcare provider if they notice any moistness, redness, or if the cord has a foul odor or has any kind of a purulent drainage. These should be reported to the healthcare provider. You'll talk to them about, you know, it's normal to have 6 to 8 wet diapers. That is an indication that the baby is being well hydrated. You'll want to remember that 6 to 8 wet diapers is indicative of adequate nutrition. We talked about the stool pattern. You want to be able to recognize what is the normal stool pattern on a breast baby. That's that yellow CD. Not formed. Diaper area, you'll want to, you know, just begin teaching now. You wipe front to back. You want to be certain, you know, you want to avoid using any kind of wipes that may have any kind of an alcohol base to them. We talked about identifying and for the newborn female, the pseudomenstruation, normal, maybe between day 7 and 10. Worth remembering. So there's some, under the teaching guidelines on page 627, goes over cord care a little bit more. Circumcision care. You know, this is kind of a, circumcisions are done by the OB doctor typically. It does require a parental consent. And this is often determined by, is the father circumcised or not? Circumcised or not? If he's not, they're probably not going to want their baby circumcised. The American Academy of Pediatrics policy statements on page 628, with the potential disadvantages and risk, as well as the medical benefits and advantages. The risk, infection, hemorrhage, skin dehiscence, adhesions, uterine fistula, and pain are the risk of the circumcision. Now, most physicians will use some sort of a little block to numb the penis before doing the circumcision, and then they may instruct the parents regarding giving some Tylenol if indicated. Sometimes just using a little bit of the what's called Toot Sweet, the little sugar water, will be enough to soothe the baby. The benefits, they are less likely to have UTIs. They're less likely to develop STIs, sexually transmitted infections, and they have a lower rate of penile cancer versus your uncircumcised male. The decision, as I said, is often a social one. It's whether the father is or not, as to whether there's, you know, his son will be. Sometimes it does involve religious, cultural, or societal family considerations. It is a personal choice. The health benefits, hygiene is easier. As I said, the decreased risk. It does require the informed consent from the parents. It's contraindicated if it's a premature, a compromised infant, they have bleeding problems or a malformed penis, such as a hypospadias. The methods are typically a GOMCO clamp or a Plastibel. On pages 715 to 16 are some figure 29, 7, and 8 shows you the two different ones, the GOMCO clamp and the Plastibel. The GOMCO clamp, once they're finished, there's nothing, you know, it's done. Whereas if they use a Plastibel, there'll be a little plastic ring left there at the base of the head of the penis that will drop off the ring and usually 7 to 10 days. You instruct them to change the diaper every 4 hours and to clean it with warm water. Again, no tub bath until it's healed. And the same as with the cord, you'll notify the healthcare provider if there's any redness, discharge, swelling, or strong odor. It's important that they know a film of yellowish mucus can form and that they're not to try to wash that off. They don't want to clean it with a pre-moistened towelette. Those oftentimes contain the alcohol. It will heal completely within a couple of weeks. Be familiar with the teaching guidelines on page 629. Screenings that are done on newborns. PKU. Hypothyroidism, galactosemia, sickle cell anemia, and the hearing screen. PKU, hypothyroidism, galactosemia, sickle cell, these are all obtained when they obtain the PKU. I don't know if you've been in newborn and were able to see this take place, them do a PKU, or if you got to draw one yourself, but that's the little filter that has. Gosh, it's been a while since I've seen one. Maybe 5 spots and they have to be completely saturated. I think in the state of Louisiana, they do 33 different testing off those screens. So it's real important that they're done. The thing with the PKU, and it may come up again, is the infant really should have 24 hours of some sort of milk. So that is for the breast babies. That's typically may not have happened prior to discharge, but we must get one by law before discharge. So it's important that the parents understand when we're asking them who they will follow up with for care, they understand that the results of this test go to that designated healthcare provider. So that if it's inconclusive, the PKU, they can do another one in the doctor's office. PKU is phenylketonuria. It is a lack of certain proteins that can be replaced through supplements in their formula. Untreated, it will result in retardation. So it is preventable. It can be treated. So they need to understand, they need to follow up with the pediatrician that they have told us they're going to see, because that's where the results of these tests will go. As I talked about previously, the hearing screening, that too is universal, done on every newborn. If it's inconclusive before discharge, they'll usually bring them back in within 6 weeks to do it. Fluid in the ear could result in, you know, not being able to get a reading out of one ear. So at 6 weeks, they'll do it again. If they still do not pass the test, then they refer them on to the ENT. Common concerns of the newborn. We talked a little bit about this, transient tachypnea of the newborn. This is your C-section babies that don't get the fluid squeezed out during delivery. So oftentimes you can listen to them and you are going to hear the wheezing, the wetness, moist sound in their lungs. It usually takes 24 hours to resolve. If the respirations stay below 80, oftentimes you can still attempt to feed these babies. You may have to gavage them. They may not tolerate trying to either suckle on the breast or suck on a bottle. That may increase the tachypnea. So you withhold feedings. If you have a respiratory rate greater than 80, and notify the healthcare provider. You identify a baby with a respiratory rate greater than 80, hold feedings, call the doctor or healthcare provider. You identify a baby that's more than a day old, more than 24 hours of age, and it's still having tachypnea. Tachypnea is described as greater than 60 beats a minute. You need to notify the healthcare provider. Things to remember. The transient tachypnea may take a few hours before you notice it. So that's why you're getting vital signs on these babies for up to 4 hours if needed, certainly the first 2 hours. If they're unable to take a bottle or breastfeed, they, as I said, you'll either do gavage feedings or they may require IV fluids. The problems you want to watch with these babies will be to make certain that they don't become hypoglycemic as a result of not eating. Physiological jaundice is going to be that jaundice that's going to occur, say, with your baby with the cephalohematoma. It usually appears between days 3 and 5. Worthy of remembering. And it's a result of, you know, the blood being reabsorbed, the delay in the breakdown, and the immaturity of the liver to process this increases the bilirubin. The major thing to remember with your babies with hyperbilirubinemia, the bilirubin is excreted through the urine and the stool, so hydration is very important. They're not eating enough. They're not going to be breaking it down and getting rid of it. Hypoglycemia is going to primarily be observed in your babies of diabetic mothers. This isn't necessarily just LGA babies. Not all diabetic mothers have these big 9-plus-pound babies. They may be smaller. So it's important to have a history on the mother and know if she had the presence of the diabetes. You'll want to watch for signs and symptoms of hypoglycemia. This is usually seen as lethargy, jitteriness. So you'll see if a nurse, you know, observes a baby like that, she's first going to check the temp to make sure the temp is within a normal range. If a baby is cold and they're burning up their calories to try to warm up, their sugar's going to drop. So they're going to check the temp, and then they're going to check their blood sugar. Blood sugar on a newborn should be greater than 40. And it's important to get that up quickly. So the interventions for transient tachypnea provide oxygen if needed, keep them warm, observe the respiratory status frequently. And like I said, it's usually 24 hours. This is allowing time for pulmonary capillaries and the lymphatics to remove the remaining fluid. The physiological jaundice begins after 24 hours a day, 24 hours of age. It peaks between days 3 and 5. It can occur with breastfeeding or formula feeding. You may need to, the baby may require phototherapy. As I said, monitor the hydration because this is how the baby is going to get rid of it. It's excreted through their urine and their stool. On page 635, the American Academy of Pediatric Guidelines for the monitoring and treatment of this are listed. So we're going to talk pathological jaundice also. So one way to distinguish if you have the presence of pathological or physiological jaundice, you'll want to remember, is you need to know the age of the baby. So you see a baby, you go in, you see a baby, and it's starting to look yellow. Then the next thing you're going to do is look to see when was this baby born. If it's less than 24 hours of age and it's starting to look yellow, this is going to be indicative of pathological jaundice. Then you're going to want to know what the mother's blood type is. And you're going to see if they've done a cord blood workup on the baby. If it's greater than 24 hours of age, then it's pathological. And you're going to be looking, do you see forceps marks on the baby? Do you see bruising on the baby? Those sort of things. But a quick quick way to determine is by knowing the age of the baby. As I said, for the hypoglycemia, they're saying concentrations less than 45 in the first 72 hours. But actually, you're certainly going to start doing some sort of interventions at 45, and you do not want it below 40. Typically, you're going to try to feed the baby. Breastfeed, if available, if that's what we're doing, or formula feeding. So you're going to get that blood sugar. It's low. You're going to feed the baby. 30 minutes after feeding, you're going to check the blood sugar again. If it's still low, then you're going to get a lab sugar. So early newborn period nutrition. So this is, we talked about the fluid intake is 100 to 140 mils per kilogram for 24 hours. The calories are 110 to 120 per kilogram of body weight. If they're not able to take in formula or breast milk, then they may require IV fluids. As I said before, it's not unusual for newborns to have a 5 to 10% weight loss from their birth weight, and it usually resumes starting around day 10 to 14. When you're feeding the newborn, bottle feeding, you'll want to make sure you're holding the baby upright. The nipple is in. You want to make sure it's on the top of the tongue, and you want the bottle tilted such that the nipple is full of formula. If it's not full, they're taking in the air also. So to reduce that, baby sitting up, bottle in the mouth, top of the tongue, tilted so that the nipple is full of formula. This will decrease the amount of air swallowing. Breastfeeding, you know, it's really important. They encourage to establish this within the first hour after birth to get in the colostrum. They feel like that's where a lot of the antigens are present to reduce the allergies. The mother may require assistance. Most places now do have your breastfeed, your lactation consultants that can also help them. But it is the nursing role to be able to assist the nursing mother also. It is considered to be the optimal source of nutrition. The colostrum is that transitional milk. It's also a natural laxative. The breast baby needs 8 to 12 feedings in a 24-hour period, meaning they should eat every 2 to 3 hours. Breast milk is easily digested. It's found to reduce the risk of SIDS, infections, allergies, and childhood obesity. And it also promotes bonding and attachment. The patient will need to be educated on pumping, storage, and expression. Milk can be stored in the refrigerator, or it can be frozen. If it's frozen, and this is covered in your book, frozen for in a non-commercial freezer, the time frame is less than it is in a commercial freezer. In NICUs, they have the commercial type freezers so that they can keep the breast milk for months upon time. It has to be at a certain temperature and things like that. So again, that's something that would be covered with the mother. Latch is a method for assessing successful breastfeeding. This will determine how well the infant latches up to the breast. You're listening for the amount of audible swallowing. You're observing the nipple type. Are both the mother and the baby appearing to have a level of comfort? And H is to assess the amount of help the mother needs. There's an example of the screening tool on page 641, table 18.7. You'll discuss with the mother hand hygiene, the importance of hydration for her. This promotes the breast milk formation. You'll want an instructor to get into a comfortable position, oftentimes a football position, where she cradles the baby's head in her hands and tucks the rest of the baby under her arm and places the baby up to the breast. Proper latch is evident when the nose, cheeks, and chin of the baby touch the breast. Hunger cues of the baby are they're mouthing their hands, they're rooting and sucking. a late stage is then when they've gotten really angry and are crying. You'll want to instruct them on rotating the breast once the milk comes in. Oftentimes the baby will empty the first breast that it suckles on, but it's not going to completely empty the second breast. So when they breastfeed the next time, they want to then go back to the last breast used so that they're ensuring with each feeding they're completely empty in one side. So you educate them on rotating if it means putting a little safety pin in their bra or, you know, keeping record of it, writing it down, but it's important that they do that. They need to recognize when the feeding and the baby is full, they slow down their suckling, their breast will be softer, and oftentimes the baby will drop off to sleep. You want to instruct them to remove the baby off the breast. They don't want to just kind of pull back. They insert their little finger into the mouth, kind of like a hook, to break the suction and then ease the nipple out. Breast babies will burp. They don't burp probably quite as much as your bottle babies because they're not taking in the air oftentimes that bottle babies do. So, question. Y'all can write this one down and then figure out, calculate it. An infant typically requires how many calories per kilogram per day during the first 3 months? What was the maximum? 110. The calories they need, 110 to 120. The meals is 100 to 150. But when we give you a problem to convert, we're going to tell you those things, okay? That a baby weighs such and such, it needs such and such, you know, how many meals in a 24-hour period does this baby need? You know, we'll give you all the information. But you have examples in Moodle. You should also practice those. I think there's one to do. So bottle feeding is just talking about the types of formula. Usually you'll ask them, do they know what their pediatrician uses? And the nurseries will know that, or if they have a preference. If they're going to use powdered milk, you want to be sure they understand that if they're using tap water, they have to boil it, or they should use distilled water. They can refrigerate formula for up to 48 hours. So you want them, if they're preparing bottles, you want them to understand, don't take, if you have a, you know, tall bottle, I don't know if that's, how many ounces that is. If the baby's not taking that in one feeding, don't put that much in the bottle. If they're only eating a couple ounces, then don't put more than 3 ounces in the bottle. As they build up and they finish that off and are still acting hungry, then you would get another. And then you will gradually increase the amount that they would put in the bottle when they prepare. But they don't need to waste it. Once they've warmed it, they can't reuse it. So they don't want to prepare a bottle with any more than, say, a half an ounce to an ounce more than what the baby is taking right then. You want to educate them. They are never to prop a bottle. And why is that?
Aspirate.
Aspiration. The baby can aspirate. See, they never put a baby down and prop it with a pillow or anything. They hold their baby in an upright position and feed the baby. Do not prop the bottle. Preparing for discharge, again, as I said, you start preparing them from the time the baby's born with the education. Car seats, you know, they are required by law. So we ask them to bring the car seat up so that the nurses can check it. They will check it when they take the baby down to make sure that it is adequately secured into the car. It should be an approved rear-facing car seat. Educate them. Most of them will have an appointment before they go home from the hospital, an appointment to see their pediatrician. Newborns should be seen and examined at the healthcare provider's office within 72 hours after discharge. Breastfeeding babies are usually seen within, or jaundice babies within 24 hours. You want to instruct them never leave the baby unattended with pets or small children, or alone on a bed or a couch. They could roll off quickly. Instruct them to place the baby on their back to sleep. No soft surface to sleep on. The mattress should be firm. There should not be any pillows. And now they're really saying no blankets. You dress the baby to keep the baby warm. Don't tie anything around their neck. Bed should not be placed next to a window to prevent the baby from getting cold. You can provide them with the immunization schedules. Again, oftentimes that may be a personal decision, but you provide them with the necessary information. You want to encourage them to avoid exposing the baby to cigarette smoke, that all visitors should wash their hands before touching the infant. Any individual with an infection should stay away. Educating them when to call their healthcare provider. If the baby has a temp of greater than 100.4 axillary, or below 97.8, you need to notify the healthcare provider. Oftentimes they'll tell you to take it at two intervals, 4 hours apart, and if it's that way, then notify them. Or if it continues to rise, you'll call them. If the baby refuses feedings and with two consecutive feedings, you'd call the doctor. If you notice the baby has any kind of cyanosis while feeding, you'd notify the doctor. If they have no wet diapers for 18 to 24 hours or fewer than the 6 to 8 wet diapers per day after day 4 of age, you notify the doctor. Or if they have two consecutive green, watery, or black stools or increased frequency of stools, you notify the doctor. Okay, so that's chapter 17. We're going to move on to chapter 18. Oh, that was 18. Chapter 23. These aren't quite as long. Some of it I really have already spoke to. This begins on page 839. We talked about previously factors that affect fetal growth: maternal nutrition, genetics, placental function, and environmental. Table 23.1 on pages 843 to 45 covers some of this. We talked about the SGA baby. This is factors affecting the growth. If less than 28 weeks, it never seems to catch up in size if it hasn't reached the appropriate size by then. Greater than 28 weeks, it's usually a result of intrauterine malnutrition, and this is oftentimes associated with the functioning of the placenta. Your IUGR baby, this is intrauterine growth retardation, is also common with your SGA babies. And the deal is the asymmetric versus the symmetric, which I spoke to y'all about. If, you know, if something is restricting one side versus the other, they may be asymmetric. On page 841, there's contributing factors, box 23.1. These babies have a wasted appearance, loose, dry skin. They have reduced subcutaneous fat stores, a decreased amount of breast tissue. Their abdomen usually has a sunken appearance. They have wide skull sutures, poor muscle tone over the buttocks and cheeks, and a thin umbilical cord. They look like they're just a little old man, is what they often look like. Nursing management is to get the weight, length, and head circumference, to monitor their blood glucose, because they do have the decreased fat stores. Vital signs are monitored. Early and frequent oral feedings, or they may require an IV of D10. You're going to monitor for signs and symptoms of polycythemia and provide anticipatory guidance for the parents. So the majority of small for gestational age newborns experience IUGR. Some SGA newborns experience IUGR, however, not all have this. So it's a matter of distinguishing between, is this baby just small for gestational age, versus your IUGR baby, who is going to look like your little old man that really has the decreased fat and the just loose, wrinkled skin. Then your LGA babies. This is often your mothers with maternal diabetes or glucose intolerance. Multiparous tend to start having larger babies if they've had a previous history of a macrosomic baby. If they're post-date, maternal obesity, if it's a boy, or genetics. Common characteristics, they're in the 90th percentile on the growth chart. Macrosomia is defined as greater than 4,000 grams. Their appearance is large body, plump, full-faced, proportional increase in their body size. Have poor motor skills and difficulty regulating behavioral states. This may be a result of birth trauma. As I said, they'll have an increase in hypoglycemia and hyperbilirubinemia, because oftentimes it's a difficult delivery that may result in some bruising. You're going to monitor their vital signs, monitor their blood glucose levels, initiate oral feedings or IV glucose supplementation as needed, and continue to monitor for hypoglycemia, early hydration, and if their belly levels increase, they'll get phototherapy. So, an LGA newborn has a wasted appearance? No. An LGA newborn usually has a large body and is plump and full-faced. Your IUGR baby has a wasted appearance. So variations in gestational age, your term baby is born from the first day of the 38th week to the 42nd. Preterm is before completion of 37 weeks. Late preterm is your 34 to 36 and 6/7 weeks. And postterm is beyond 42 weeks. So your postterm baby, I don't know that we talked a whole lot about this. Postterm baby has now developed the inability of the placenta to provide adequate oxygen and nutrients to the fetus. Pregnancy set up to be 42 weeks, and when it goes past that, then the placenta starts to grow old. These babies often will appear with dry, cracked, wrinkled skin. Oftentimes it's going to be meconium stained. They have long, thin extremities with long nails, creases over the entire soles of their feet. They'll be wide-eyed, alert expression, kind of like, what took you so long to get me out of there, you know? Abundant hair on the scalp. A lot of times their umbilical cord will be real thin and stained looking, and they'll have very little vernix or lanugo. You're going to monitor their blood glucose, initiate feedings, begin an IV if they're not tolerating feedings, prevent heat loss, evaluate how well they're doing. These babies have a 2 to 3 times mortality than term babies, because of the fact that the placenta deteriorates so quickly, affecting nourishment and oxygenation. Etiology leading to preterm births, maternal infections or inflammation may result in a preterm birth. Your patients that present during pregnancy with a UTI, they had high risk to develop preterm labor. So they're going to get them hydrated and treated quickly. If, you know, there's bleeding that occurs during the pregnancy, depending on the what presented that bleeding, then may result in some preterm labor. So, and then stretching, just as the uterus stretches, you know, can the body tolerate that increase in size? It may stimulate labor. The preterm baby is affected because of the immaturity with the respiratory system, cardiovascular, GI, renal, immune, and central nervous system. Their characteristics are usually weigh less than 5.5 pounds. They're scrawny, they have poor muscle tone, minimal sub-Q fat, typically your males, the undescended testes. They have plentiful lanugo, poorly formed ear pinna, so that when you fold the ear forward, it usually will stay that way. If it's an extremely premature baby, the eyelids may be fused. This is usually going to be your 23-week babies. Soft, spongy skull bones, matted scalp hair. They have absent or few creases in their soles and palms. Minimal scrotal rugae, prominent labia and clitoris, thin, transparent skin, and abundance of vernix. Common problems accompanying this is hypothermia, hypoglycemia, hyperbilirubinemia. They may require extra oxygenation. They're going to require thermal regulation. They're going to require nutrition and fluid balance. They need to be treated to prevent infections. They'll need minimal stimulation. And you want to provide developmental care. Evidence-based practice of 23.1 talks about developmental care. And then, you know, the parental support. Parents need to understand what's going on with their baby. What are you doing? You need to explain all of the equipment and the treatments that are taking place. So when treating, when assessing a newborn, which would you, the nurse, expect to find? Limited lanugo? No, it's going to have a lot. Few palmar creases? Not many. Wrinkled thick skin? No. Wide-eyed expression? No, that's your post-term. So you're going to expect that you will find few palmar creases. We're going to briefly talk about dealing with perinatal loss. Any pregnancy loss or neonatal death up to 1 month of age, you know, a woman, once she knows she's pregnant and then she loses that pregnancy at any time, it is a loss. It is a loss she'll always remember. It's a profound experience for the family. You know, it's common then for people just want to avoid talking about it. But they need to be able to acknowledge, you need to acknowledge that there was a pregnancy. You know, so there are grief support groups for those experiencing the loss and the family members if needed. You know, the thing, nurses need to be aware of their personal feelings regarding it and how they can communicate with that patient. Refer to the table on page 864. There's also different videos out there to talk to cover. A lot of times, I know, like at Christus Highland, what we did in the NI when it was at Shumford, as once a year we would have a service inviting those parents who had experienced a loss at any time during their pregnancy or during the neonatal period to come back. We recognized these infants and we gave them opportunities to speak to it. We'd tell them to bring, if they wanted, we'd have areas that they could display any mementos that they had of the baby. You know, if they had been presented with a little box that, you know, usually what they would do in the NI is they would footprint the baby or handprint the baby. They'd have a clip of hair or maybe the last outfit it had on and they'd put them in a little memory box. And so it's important to acknowledge and give the parents that opportunity also. Chapter 24 is going to talk about nursing management of the newborns at risk through acquired or congenital newborn conditions. Again, a lot of this I've talked about as we talked about the physical assessment and everything. So we're just going to kind of review. Acquired, this typically occurs at or soon after birth. Problems or conditions experienced by the woman during her pregnancy or at birth, or there may possibly be no identifiable cause for the disorder. Whereas congenital is present at birth, it's usually due to some type of malformation occurring during the antepartum period, or it may typically be some problem with inheritance. The majority of these will have a complex etiology. So acquired conditions of the newborn, neonatal asphyxia. Again, the baby may have experienced this intrauterine and we have no way of knowing when or what may have triggered it. The transient tachypnea of the newborn, that's your C-section babies. Respiratory distress, this is usually your preterm babies. Meconium aspiration, if the baby pooped in the nest before delivery, then they may aspirate some of that meconium. Persistent pulmonary hypertension of the newborn is typically with your preterm babies also, as is your peri-intraventricular hemorrhage. Necrotizing enterocolitis is also associated with preterms. Your infants of your diabetic mothers, they may, have birth trauma. They may have trouble with their glucose. Newborns of perinatal substances, those mothers abusing. These babies are at risk for seizures and going through withdrawal. Hyperbilirubinemia, this would be your physiological, usually with the bruising, or they may acquire infection. If the mother had Group B strep, wasn't treated, the baby may acquire it. Hypoxic ischemia, hypoxia, ischemic encephalopathy. This asphyxia occurs when adequate breathing is not established after birth. Insufficient oxygen delivery to meet metabolic demands. The risk factors, was it a difficult delivery? Did the mother get sedation right before delivery and the baby is really sedated and just, not breathing like it needs to? You're going to assess the baby's color, its pattern of breathing. Is it having trouble? Is it retracting, grunting? What is the heart rate? The temp, and what are the Apgar scores? If at 1 minute you have a score less than 7, this then is usually indicative of some type of resuscitative measure should be going on. Be it maybe just having to stimulate the baby, maybe give a little blow by oxygen. If you have a 5 or less, then you're going to begin doing more intensive resuscitation that may require cardiac compressions, ventilation, intubation, those type of things. The management, immediate resuscitation, continued observation, a neutral thermal environment, checking their blood glucose. If they've been stressed, it's going to also drop their blood sugars. You want to make sure the parents understand what's going on again and what you're doing for the baby. We talked about the transient tachypnea. It usually resolves within 72 hours. So again, if you're assessing a newborn, and you're hearing this wet sound in their lungs, it's important for you to know, how did this baby deliver? Was it a section or vaginal birth? And how old is this baby? If it's less than 24 hours old and it's a C-section baby, then you know that this should resolve. Again, you need an assessment. You need to know what took place maternal-wise. Did she get any sedation? Was the birth by cesarean? And then you're going to assess the baby for tachypnea. Any expiratory grunting, retractions, labored breathing, nasal flaring, and mild cyanosis. A chest x-ray will show mild symmetric lung hyperaeration with a prominent perihilar interstitial marks and streaks. Nursing management is typically oxygenation, supportive care, IV fluids or gavage feedings, because you're not going to try to nipple a baby that's breathing over 80 times a minute. It may require supplemental oxygen, and they need a neutral thermal environment to maintain their temperature. Neonatal asphyxia commonly resolves within 72 hours after birth. False. Neonatal asphyxia requires immediate resuscitation measures and may lead to hypoxic ischemia encephalopathy. Transient tachypnea of the newborn typically resolves within 72 hours of age. So pay attention to what we're asking and the wording. Not saying neonatal asphyxia, it may be that, or it may say transient tachypnea. There is a difference. Respiratory distress, this is typically found in your premature infants. It is lung immaturity and a lack of valvular surfactant. You want to identify the risk factors. You want to observe, is there expiratory grunting, nasal flaring, chest wall retractions, C-cell respirations, and generalized cyanosis. Typically the heart rate's greater than 150 to 180. You will hear fine inspiratory crackles, and they'll have tachypnea. Again, these are typically, this is your preterm baby. A meconium aspiration baby, this is a baby who has inhalation of particulate meconium within the amniotic fluid into the lungs. Usually it's secondary to hypoxic stress. The baby will have stooled as a result of having experienced some sort of a hypoxic episode. You will see if it's occurred in utero, the fluid is going to typically be, amniotic fluid will be stained green. The baby, if it's what we call an old episode, their nails, their skin, and their umbilical cord will have a green stain to them. If the fluid has been stained for a considerable time, the babies will have a barrel-shaped chest with prolonged tachypnea. They'll have increasing respiratory distress, intercostal retractions, and end expiratory grunting and cyanosis. Their ABGs will show metabolic acidosis. And these babies, they have a, they're at a high risk of expiring. It's important to suction at birth to make sure that there's no, to try to ensure there's nothing there close to the trachea for the baby when it takes that first breath to suck it in. So typically, they will, when the head is delivered, they'll have a setup with a wall suction for the doctor to suction out the baby's mouth. Well, and then the nose to try to make sure if there's any meconium present, they're getting it. You want to ensure they have adequate tissue perfusion. And you want to decrease their oxygen demand and energy expenditure, so giving them blow by if needed. Keep them in a neutral thermal environment and educate and prepare the parents. Persistent pulmonary hypertension is not something, unless you're typically in an NICU, that you're going to see. This is marked pulmonary hypertension causing right to left extrapulmonary shunting and hypoxia. Again, this is an NICU baby. So the underlying problem associated with meconium aspiration syndrome in utero involves a hypoxic stress. True. Meconium may be passed in utero secondary to hypoxic stress. So predisposing factors for the development of necrotizing enterocolitis. Again, this is typically your NICU babies that have been in the NI for a while, and they begin the feedings, and it's a matter of, or the feedings begun too soon, the gut's just not ready. Just for your information, just to know that NEC is necrotizing enterocolitis. It's found typically in your NI. You're not going to see this in your newborn nurseries. Or if you do, they're going to boot them up to NI quickly. You may see infants of diabetic mothers. These have high levels of maternal glucose that have crossed through the placenta, stimulating increased fetal insulin. So oftentimes these babies are going to be born and they're going to have a good blood glucose initially, but give them about an hour and they will crater. So this is important to monitor these babies. Common problems they may experience is on page 887, table 24.1. The nursing management is going to be the prevention, so early feedings, maintaining a neutral thermal environment, decreasing stress, limited stimulation, maintenance of fluid and electrolyte balance, parental support and education. On page 889, table 24.2 discusses this. Newborns and substance abuse mothers, the most common substances, tobacco, alcohol, and marijuana, table 24.4. Fetal alcohol syndrome is a physical and mental disorder appearing at birth and remaining problematic throughout the child's life. There's a picture in on your Moodle shell of how these babies appear. They have the high brow. They have the flat nose, a wide bridge. They have a very distinctive appearance. So look over box 24.2. Fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, again, learning disabilities, alcohol-related birth defects, mainly it's their appearance. And it's not so much that it's a birth defect as that it is a very obvious appearance that these children have. Neonatal abstinence syndrome, drug dependency acquired in utero. These babies, it may take, again, about 24 hours before withdrawal starts to appear. And so you're monitoring these babies closely for any kind of seizure activity. Birth trauma is a result of injuries due to the forces of labor and birth. The types you may see are fractures, a brachial plexus injury, cranial nerve trauma, head trauma such as the cephalohematoma, the caput sedium. Look at page 890, table 24.3 kind of goes over this. You want to identify risk factors. You need to have a good report on how the birth went. Was it a difficult birth? You're going to observe the baby for bruising, bumps, swelling, any paralysis, symmetry of structure and function. Educate the parents. You know, the physician, if necessary, will refer the baby if they require additional follow-up care.
Yes, I do live on
the newborns of substance abusing mothers. Kind of, I've talked about this. The main thing is with these babies, it's going to take about 24 hours before you begin to see withdrawal. So there is a form, it's called a neonatal abstinence. that they will score the baby, and depending on the scores, how it puts them at risk to develop these withdrawal symptoms, which typically will be seizures. The management is comfort, promotion, stimuli reduction, nutrition. Again, probably dependent on the type of substance, there may be parent-newborn interaction. And so they may not actually have that. And that's where, if we had these type of babies in the NI and there was not any kind of parent able to see the baby, then we had volunteers that would come in to hold these babies and rock them, because they are very hypersensitive to stimuli, but they will respond to being, you know, swaddled and held closely and rocked. So we would utilize volunteers for that. Again, just kind of going over, I know I've gone over this and over, but you will be seeing this in a newborn unit. They identify as hyperbilirubin number one. This is your, they're saying the two types, physiological. Usually occurs between the third and fourth day as a result of bruising, typically. You want to try early onset breastfeeding. Late onset breastfeeding jaundice may occur if they, you know, are slow to get nutrition in, hydration in. Pathological jaundice occurs within the first 24 hours of life. It's usually related to an Rh isoimmunization or an ABO incompatibility. So that's why our Rh negative and O positive mothers, they typically will get do a cord blood workup on the baby to see what the baby's blood type is. If you have an Rh negative mother and the baby is positive, then the mother is going to require an additional Rogam injection that has to be administered within 72 hours. If you have the Rh negative mother and you have a positive baby that has a positive Coons, then they may have an ABO incompatibility. With either, they're going to develop early onset of jaundice. If they require phototherapy, the thing to remember with phototherapy is that you have to cover the eyes. You want to strip the baby down usually to just a diaper. You rotate their positions, and you need to monitor their I and O, because they excrete through the urine and the stool, so they need adequate hydration in order for this to occur. So we talked about the hepatic system. The liver being immature, so it has impaired excretion, resulting in the slowing down and breaking down of the blood and excreting the bilirubin. Good feedings are essential. Breastfeeding jaundice may occur due to decreased excretion due to the dehydration. It occurs in the first few days of life. Once good breastfeeding is established, it will resolve. Usually, the bilirubin levels will rise after the first week of life for the breast milk jaundice. Sometimes if it just gets too high, they may interrupt breastfeeding for a period of time, usually just a couple days, to get the and hydrate the baby with formula to get the bilirubin down, and then they can resume breastfeeding. So the pathological is the one I talked about with the risk factors of the Rh negative mother. The baby will have early onset of jaundice. The signs of Rh incompatibility, the baby will have a positive Coons. There's a comparison chart on chart 24.1 that kind of goes over comparing the two, pathological and physiological. You know, the nursing management is to get the bilirubin levels reduced by early feeding, phototherapy, exchange transfusions would be one of those last things they would do. They do now do home phototherapy, you know, where they'll send the baby home. It's typically put under what they call a billy blanket that the baby lays on that has the lights in it, and then they rotate the positions. Their teaching guidelines, teaching guidelines 24.2, you'll want to be sure and look over those. Newborn infections. Neonatal sepsis may be a bacterial, fungal, or viral. Microorganisms or their toxins in the blood or other tissues. You have congenital, this acquired into uterine. Early onsets in the perinatal period or lung onset. There's a comparison chart 24.2, refer to it. Nursing assessment is evaluating risk factors. Again, group B strep, did the mother get the treatment that was needed or not? Did she have any other things? Did she have a history of any STDs? Was she treated for them recently? Does she have herpes? When was her last active lesion? Has she been treated for it? So an important, you know, you need to know maternal history. There may be non-specific symptoms. So, you know, again, you'll be getting lab works. Management will be antibiotic therapy. You want to provide circulatory, respiratory, nutritional, and developmental support. You want to educate the parents for early recognition. If they get home, baby's got the temp. You know, if they're not eating appropriately, if they're having watery stools, to notify the healthcare provider. Congenital conditions and neural tube defects. Those are your myelocells coming out off of the spine. Esophageal atresia or tracheal esophageal fistula. You can't pass a feeding tube because there's a blind pouch there. Omphalocele gastroschisis. This is coming from the abdomen. The imperfect anus, if it's closed off. Bladder extrophy is if the bladder's outside of the body. So those again would be in the NICU. So let me just quickly go over a few things to make sure that we did identify and y'all can remember for me. So the hip assessment, identifying if there's any kind of hip dysplasia. Vitamin K, why and where do we give it? So under phototherapy, cover the eyes, monitor the INO. Physiological jaundice peaks at 3 days. It's important to distinguish between the two is by knowing the age of the infant. A pink poplar rash on the newborn is erythema toxicum. It is normal. You're going to educate them never to prop the bottle. If you identify a baby that appears to be cold stressed, the first thing you can do is wrap the baby in two warm blankets and place a hat on its head. You'll check the temp again in 30 minutes. Then if it is not coming up, you would move to a radiant heat source or an enclosed isolate. We administer the erythromycin ophthalmia to prevent ophthalmia neonatorium. That's if the baby's been exposed to any, particularly gonorrhea, chlamydia, through the birth process. Ophthalmia neonatorium. You'll want to be able to convert pounds to grams. To be able to distinguish a newborn weight loss, is it within or less than the 5 to 10 percentile? You have a baby that requires 115 kilocalories per day, and it weighs 7 pounds, 4 ounces. How many calories does it need? Refer to the examples on the Moodle shell. Review the reflex chart. Morrow, Babinski's, Grasp. Something I don't think we really talked a great deal about, but as far as educating the mother in regards to infant induction, she needs to know how to identify who would be the appropriate person to take her baby from the room. As far as their personnel, they should have a picture ID badge that should indicate where they're from. Oftentimes, even newborn nurseries will use a secondary form of ID that they'll communicate to the parent who it is. But you also want to instruct your parent, you don't want to leave the baby in the room unattended. If the mother decides she needs to take a nap and there's nobody else in there to watch the baby, then she should notify the nursery and ask them to, you know, take her baby to the nursery. So you just need to make sure they understand those things. We know that adequate nutrition is reflected in 6 to 8 wet diapers a day. One of the potential symptoms of sepsis would be if you have trouble maintaining the temp on the newborn. There will be one delegation question on what would be appropriate to assign to the LPN. Remember your T assessment, or is it EAT? Assessment, education, planning, the nurse, the RN has to do. Identify what a breastfeeding stool will look like. In the newborn census, we know that the vision is probably the least mature at birth. And that ought to help you study. Any questions? I've kind of wrapped up a little early because Natchitoches apparently has the class at 12:30 that starts, so they need to be able to empty the room out. So did Kylie ever make it? I have your parking sticker. All right, if y'all have any questions, like I said, we'll get the study guide. It may already be posted. If not, it will be this afternoon.
It is.
And it is posted. Thank you, Ms. Rigger.